From the record of Lin Ji. My friends, try and apply my insight. Sit still and cut off the heads of every Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya body of the Buddha. See that all bodhisattvas in the 10 bodhisattva stages, all the fully awakened and wonderful awakened ones, are just like shackles coming to imprison you. Arhats and self-enlightened ones are like the latrine pit. Awakening and nirvana are tethering posts for mules. Why? Because you have not been able to realize clear understanding of the emptiness of 3 incalculably long kalpas, you run into the obstacles which you are presently experiencing. If you practiced correctly the true teachings, it would not be like that. You just need to use these favorable circumstances to put an end to your past karma. Put on your robe as a free person. When it is necessary to walk, walk. When it is necessary to sit, sit. Do not for a moment yearn for Buddhahood. So I wanted to read this section this morning in appreciation of Lin Ji's ornery nature. Sometimes when we think about Buddhism and about the Buddhas and ancestors, we may form an idea, an impression that this whole thing is about being softer and kinder, sweeter, and more obedient. But one of the things I really appreciate about Zen in general, and certainly Lin Ji in particular, is that he's not a person who's afraid to say very difficult things. And we find this in a lot of the teachings that have been handed down to us from the Tang and Sung dynasties in China, from the 8th to the 10th or 11th century. These people who wield sticks and shout, who say things that seem on the surface quite harsh. Some of you may remember the story of Lin Ji's awakening that we talked about a while back, where his teacher keeps interrupting him and hitting him with a stick whenever he tries to ask about Buddhism. And as a young practitioner, he was trying always to do the right thing. And his teacher met that earnestness with a stick. This can seem quite violent, but if we look into it a little more deeply and look into our own hearts, we can see that there's a kind of oppositional quality that many of us have that is not a problem. It's a problem when we make it into active oppositional behavior that might hurt other people, when it transforms into violence, into a kind of division of the heart where there's me and all the rest of them, and I'm right and all the rest of them are wrong, and we have to show them the errors of their ways. If you are honest, you know that possibly hiding deep within your own heart, or maybe for some of us it's closer to the surface, there is this oppositional quality. This is the quality that sometimes we call the bullshit detector. We hear teachings of Buddhism and some part of us goes, wait a minute, what? No, that doesn't make sense. Give me a break. This is a very useful quality to have. We're told that when these teachings of Lin Ji were first written down, really about 100 years after he lived, they were further refined over the next 150 years. And some of the things that he said that were a little bit milder, like things are defiled, were turned into much more disturbing imagery like latrine pits and tethering posts for mules. I guess that's only disturbing if you have a thing about mules. This spirit of Linji is so valuable. All by itself, it can get us into trouble, but when it's balanced with the true love of the Dharma that so many of us have, then it transforms, we don't do it, by the way, it transforms all by itself into this great energy of practice called in Sanskrit bodhicitta, the wisdom heart, sometimes called in Japanese juriki, a kind of energy that is generated through the power of zazen. Just sitting generates this great power for the way, this great yearning towards awakening. Everything that brings us to practice starts as a problem, a longing to know, a feeling that things aren't quite right, this oppositional heart that many of us have. But these things, these qualities that seem problematic, transform into a clarity, a wisdom, a strength of practice. Last night, David gave a wonderful talk about the three bodies of the Buddha, the Dharmakaya body, the Sambhogakaya body, and the Nirmanakaya body. And in this passage, Linji refers to two of the bodies, the Sambhogakaya and the Nirmanakaya body. And just a brief review, the Dharmakaya body is the body of thusness, of shunyata, of nothingness, emptiness, completeness. It's the still space, the still spot around it, which everything revolves. It can't be spoken about. It can only be experienced, and then as soon as the mind comes in and starts talking about it, it transforms into one of the other two bodies of the Buddha. The Sambhogakaya body is the bliss body, the appreciation body. This is when everything is so wonderful. The Dharmakaya cannot be remarked upon, but the Sambhogakaya can be. And the Nirmanakaya, which is the activity body, the body of actual awakened activity, walking, sitting, cooking, breathing. So out of this great stillness, out of this great nothingness, everything arises, sometimes as activity, sometimes as appreciation. And we have a saying in Zen that just thusness, just this simple presence, this awakened nature that has no attributes at all. We sometimes say that we put a head on top of our own head. The actual matter is simple and straightforward, but we try to, or it tries to manifest itself as more complicated than the utter simplicity of the Dharmakaya, of the body of the truth. And so when Linji says that we have to cut off the heads of the Sambhogakaya and the Nirmanakaya, he's not saying this in a way that human beings would understand cutting off another human being's head. But we have to cut off this extra head that we put on top of our own heads. We have to not get lost in making awakening into anything. And he's ruthless about this particular view, this view of transforming everything that happens to us into some kind of story, some kind of dream that we carry around with us as if it were something. And it's just, these things just get in our way. And when we hear people talking about their enlightenment experiences, when we hear people talking about how great Zen is, how great Buddhism is, our bullshit detectors should start rising up. Because that's all extra. It's a second head on top of the thing itself. This extremely simple practice. It's not that complicated. And yet, human minds are infinitely complicated, and so we keep creating all these forms of Buddhism, and they're great, they're wonderful, they point to the thing itself, but the problem is that we can start, as we say, mistaking the forest for the trees. We can think that all these teachings are it, when what's actually it is just this. So he says, sit still. And when he says, cut off the heads of every Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya body of the Buddha, this is what he's talking about. He's saying, don't be fooled. Even awakening itself can transform into a thing. Many of you know that The Three Pillars of Zen is this wonderful book that was edited and put together by Philip Kaplow Roshi, the founder of the Rochester Zen Center, which is having this year in 2016 its 50th anniversary. And a new edition of this book has been issued. And the current guiding teacher of the Rochester Zen Center, Bodhin Kholje Roshi, has written a new introduction to the book. And the last part of the book is a series of very excited narratives about Zen awakenings that when I read the book, I found them inspirational, and then they got in my way. They were like these extra heads, because the only way you can talk about awakening is through the lens of Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya, and these awakening stories are really juicy and wonderful and have created lots and lots of problems for 50 years of Zen students, many generations already now of Zen students, thinking that, oh wait, I should have an experience like that. My experiences are nothing like that. I guess I haven't had these awakened experiences that everybody's talking about. Oh well, I'm just a failure. Forget about it. And Bodhin writes that, I haven't read it, but I've just heard about it, a corrective. You know, take this lightly. Don't put a head on top of your head, he might have said. And Lin Ji, in his dynamic way, says, cut off those heads. Don't even get involved with all that stuff. And all the bodhisattvas in the 10 bodhisattva stages, there are all these things in Buddhism about stages of awakening, especially in the Theravada school. The original teachings from the Pali Suttas, you get all these different ways of evaluating your own practice. You're in the third stage or the seventh stage, or somebody reported to somebody recently that she was in the 25th stage. whatever that means, that's great. It's a nice way to mark your progress, I guess. Except in Zen, there's no progress. There's just a kind of cutting off, a sloughing off, a waiting for the layers to drop away until the simplicity of being human is recognized. By what? I don't know. Not by us, certainly. It's just something we start living into. So all of these things, the wonderful awakened ones, Lin Ji says, they're like shackles. They bind us. They prevent us from living this free life of being a human being, which is the promise of Zen. Arhats, that's a word for people who are realized but not quite Buddhas. This is a Theravada phrase, a Theravada word. Self-enlightened ones is a translation of another form of one of these stages. They're like the latrine pit. They're like where we poop and piss. That's the strong language of Lin Ji. Don't get fooled by these things. They seem golden and beautiful and certainly not me. They're a way that we can hurt ourselves, deeply hurt ourselves, by comparing ourselves to these ideas about awakening. an awakening itself, nirvana, the cessation of everything that arises as delusion, tethering posts for mules. In Zen, we sometimes say it's like a person up a tree holding onto a branch with her teeth. No way to go. If you are attached to awakening, if you're attached to nirvana or some idea of it, you're shackled, you're in the latrine pit, you're no better than a post that mules can be tied up to. And why? Because this emptiness can't be understood. It can't be defined. It can't be named. It can't be talked about. When people start talking about it, then we know a problem is arising. We run into all of the obstacles, Linji says, that we're presently experiencing. So there's a little story, actually a couple of stories that relate to this. One is a story from my own life, but I think I'll wait to tell that and first tell this story about Linji, which inspired me to read this section today. It's a famous story about when he was on pilgrimage. This is after his awakening experience with his teacher, Wang Bo. And he goes to a holy place. Already we can see there might be a problem arising. A holy place. This is the place where Bodhidharma was supposedly buried. So Bodhidharma, who lived many centuries before Linji and was supposedly the Indian teacher who brought this practice of Zen from India to China, who we revere as our first Chinese ancestor, although he was Indian, and we just recited his name in our lineage dedication. Bodhidharma, this great, also ornery person. There are many stories about his orneriness, but I won't talk about them right now. In a way, maybe Linji, I'm imagining, could have felt a connection to Bodhidharma and wanted to go to his burial place. And the person who tended the burial place met Linji, and when Linji arrived, he said, "So which are you going to bow to and make offerings to first, to the Buddha or to Bodhidharma?" This reminded me of a child-rearing tip that David and I got when our daughter was very young. She didn't like to get dressed in the morning, and so we would lay out her clothes and say, "Do you want to wear the red shirt or the blue shirt?" And it was a trick, right, because she had to pick one of those two shirts. Which one are you going to bow to, the Buddha or Bodhidharma? A little bit of a trick. You got to bow, so which one are you going to do first? And Linji said, "I'm not going to bow to either one of them." And the guy who was taking care of this stupa, this burial mound, was very upset by this and said, what have the Buddhas and ancestors ever done to you to make you not bow to them?" And Linji just waved his long sleeves and walked off. He didn't answer. What answer is there to this? Later in his life, he gives this talk and answers the question of the keeper of the burial mound. Both the Buddha and Bodhidharma are just figures. They're extra heads. They're not the thing itself. Why bow down to them? Of course, this was when he was young and even more ornery than he became later in his life, although from all the stories, he never relented and never softened much. But he did bow when bowing was necessary. He did sit when sitting was necessary. He walked when walking was necessary. And this is his advice that he gives to us. At the end of this passage, he says, "This is how you do it. Put on your robe as a free person. When it's necessary to walk, walk. When it's necessary to sit, sit." Buried right in this teaching is all the direction we need. We might be inspired by the Buddhas and ancestors, and that's a great thing. We might be inspired by all these different ways of conceptualizing awakening, and that can be a good thing too. The stories in the Three Pillars of Zen could be inspiring to us. All those books that so many of us read endlessly, inspiring maybe some important information, only if they're mirrors that reflect back our actual experience. But ultimately, all that stuff just has to drop away so that we can experience this moment, which is everything. This moment is everything. This sitting here, this listening, this talking, the sound of the traffic going by. There's nothing but this. In a little while, there'll be other things. But right now, just this body breathing, this heart beating. We don't have to busy the mind, even though we're addicted to busying the mind. We don't have to do it. And we can use our basic orneriness, the oppositional qualities in our heart, to understand the ruthlessness of Linji's teaching, to not settle for anything but the thing itself, to never believe anything that we hear from the outside unless we use it as guidance into our own hearts. And Linji then says, do not for a moment yearn for Buddhahood. That's a tricky thing that he's saying here. Because, of course, we do yearn for Buddhahood, but we don't know what Buddhahood is. So we end up yearning for the wrong things. We go a million miles away from what's right here. Our life unfolding moment by moment is Buddhahood. It is the awakened nature. It is everything we've ever wanted. When we clear the path so that we can walk freely, this is how we realize our awakened nature. So Linji said, my friends, try and apply my insight. Sit still and cut off the heads of every Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya body of the Buddha. See that all bodhisattvas in the 10 bodhisattva stages, all the fully awakened and wonderful awakened ones, are just like shackles coming to imprison you. Arhats and self-enlightened ones are like the latrine pit. Awakening and nirvana are tethering posts for mules. Why? Because you have not been able to realize clear understanding of the emptiness of three incalculably wrong long kalpas, you run into the obstacles which you are presently experiencing. If you practiced correctly the true teachings, it would not be like that. You just need to use these favorable circumstances to put an end to your past karma. Put on your robe as a free person. When it is necessary to walk, walk. When it is necessary to sit, sit. Do not for a moment yearn for Buddhahood. Thank you. Now please make yourselves comfortable. And we'll have our Dharma dialogue, where you can come forward as yourself and ask a question, make a comment about the talk, the passage, or anything coming up in your practice. Derek?
Buddhism doesn't really, it's not really a repository for beliefs. Like, it doesn't say you should believe in God or not believe in God or believe in an afterlife or not an afterlife. But it seems like the training phrase is like everything you ever wanted is right here in this moment. It seems like that's almost a belief, and we need to have faith in that, because it seems like a belief to me, because when I'm with my extended family and they have the other view of this is not it. It's really tough. What do you say to that? What can you do? And seems like a belief to me, and that seems so, just you don't come across many beliefs in Buddhism.
Right.
But it did, I mean, so it, you know, you have to start out with faith, but then it, you realize it for yourself, and it's not a
right.
belief anymore.
Right.
It's the truth.
Just what I was going to say. Yeah, and this is, you know, referring to the three pillars of Zen again, our faith, determination, and doubt. There is a faith element in Zen, but it's not a faith, like you're pointing out an important distinction. It's not buying into something, believing, but it's like, wait a minute, all these people for all these centuries have discovered this thing and keep pointing it out, and the faith sort of arises in the heart, I think, based on experience. So it keeps matching. It's like when I first encountered Buddhist teachings, I already knew it, but nobody had ever said it before. And you know, with my family and my friends, I looked around and thought, why don't they know it? And I was quite obnoxious, I think, the first few months of my, maybe years, I can't remember.
Of years. My,
years. Decades. you know, it's like, this is the coolest thing, you should really do. And, oh man, boy, that was a big mistake.
Even presenting a question like, what if this is it? You
know, yeah,
it
yeah.
It gets people's blood boiling.
Yeah, it does. Yes. I remember a student in the early days of the Worcester Zen community who came up after a talk like this and said, why do you keep saying this? It's not here. This is terrible. My life is terrible. Yeah, yeah. That's and that's a that you're right. That's a belief and also an element of faith. And this talk was mostly about the doubt mind, but I'm glad you brought this in.
Yeah, I think that these training phrases, it's really important how we use them, because we can use them to cover over our innate wisdom, right? We can use them like, well, I better believe it, even though, because sometimes I hear, this is it, and my blood boils, right? You're kidding me, right? And how in ourselves and with the people we encounter, to allow that to be true. So these teachings then are pointers, you know. So and I like that phrasing, not everything we want is already here, but what if everything we wanted is here, you know, so that we can then investigate it. Well, is that so, you know, and this great invitation to do it. And then the other thing is, if this is it, that means even opposition to this is it, is it. but I think you named so poignantly, both on the outside and the inside, that our natural response to opposition is to want to obliterate it, you know, to overcome it. And how to even value that opposition. And there, of course, there's no harder place to practice than with our family. You know, it's all of the rules go out the window, all of the good intentions, and everybody's blood is boiling. You know, so great and wonderful training.
You said something that sort of turned my head in. It was a turning word, but not big Kensho. But it was, I'm sorry.
Oh.
It was a wonderful pointer for practice because, so I had read Philip Kaplow's book and I had read the Enlightenment stories and I had that reaction of, oh, I haven't had that. So, you know, I'm chopped liver. And James Ford has sometimes called those descriptions Kensho porn. And I found myself making a division that those descriptions are bad. They shouldn't even be out there. And I think what you made me see was that no, all these teachings, even the sutras in our sutra book, some of them don't resonate with my experience, and that's okay. They don't need to, as long as I don't make a thing of thinking they need to. That I can just see what reflects.
Right.
My experience, and sometimes they will be opaque to me, and then a line of the sutras will jump out at me. It's like, oh, because my experience has revealed it. And so I realize that what you're describing is a way to use everything, all these teachings, without either putting heads on them or rejecting them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
I'm afraid I'm having a major senior moment, but did you tell the anecdote from your own experience?
You know, I didn't. I thought I could get away with it just by mentioning the red shirt and the blue shirt, but I didn't, but I will.
That's enough. I just wanted
okay.
to make sure.
Well, you make a promise and then you don't fulfill it. It's a hypnotic technique, actually. When is she going to say it? Yeah. Well, it was just a moment of orneriness when I first met David. because this, I think this, you know, this blood boiling thing, it's such an important part of our characters, and we sometimes try to be so nice. Mm. And this practice really isn't about being nice, you know. We've discovered, right? And it was so. David and this guy named Blaine were co-coordinators of a food co-op, a natural food co-op. This was in the 70s, and Blaine was going to India, and they needed to hire somebody to replace him. So they hired me. And the first time that the three of us had breakfast together, or lunch. It was lunch. And I was just feeling this, you know, natural health food, natural foods co-op, and everything is perfect and pure. And I was my bullshit detector was way up. You know, and these guys, you know, David and Blaine were these kind, warm,
you can imagine.
Long hair.
Just
you know, everything was just, they spoke in very, very soft voices. This was not how I'd been raised. And my father was a grocer, so I knew a little bit about the grocery business. And we went to this diner, and you know, that they made a big deal. Oh, well, we're vegetarians, and we've got to find the right food. And I ordered liver and onions. And I remember David looking at me curiously,
with desire.
My dad.
It wasn't for the liver. So that was the strike. Thanks for the invitation, Todd. I couldn't figure out a way to work it into the talk. It was an idea I had. Thank you, Susan. And it's that spirit still arises, I have to say, often.
Well, and I think that Linji is such a wonderful iconoclast. An iconoclast is someone who takes whatever is being worshipped and breaks it, you know. So this freedom that, you know, as we've said, there's the new tyranny of Zen,
right?
We get on the Zen path, and then Zen has all of these, you know, subtle things. Well, you know, you're supposed to look like this and do that and be, you know, whatever. And we each make it up. And Linchi is so wonderful at reminding us that that's just as problematic. So the new Zen rules are just as problematic, or the New Age rules, or the, you know, whatever. So this constant vigilance and this robe of freedom doesn't come with instructions, right? Because any instructions for freedom are instructions. They're just another jail cell. Now we've got a great Zen jail to live in, you know, but something beyond even Zen jail.
And I want to say that this is just one side of it, right? Because there is this whole other side of experience that is really beautiful and wonderful, and you know, we can be vegetarians, we can do all kinds of things, but not because it's the right thing to do or there's some idea, because it really speaks to our hearts. That's a very different thing. I'm doing this because it's right, and you guys are all wrong. It's very different from, oh, this has been nourishing to me. Mm-hmm. And it actually goes back to Derek's question, I think, too. How do you treat the people in your family who think that Zen is bullshit? And you don't try to argue with them, right? 'Cause Because it's a losing proposition. But to just keep practicing and sincerely recognizing that everybody is doing just what they're supposed to do in this life, you know, within limits.
And in accordance with what you said last night, Melissa, in a relation with the three Kayas, you work with them, and at first I was surprised you say that, and then a light, sometimes it needs time for me, and I said, yes, finally it's the same for me, because I receive a Tibetan teaching, which are more analytical.
Analytical.
Yeah. And Zen teaching, it's another way of practicing and open the view as well, and see the reality differently.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
And I'm like you. I'm living in an extended family, and they help me all the time to open my view. I mean, it's even sometimes I don't know, it's impossible. And I live in another country as well than mine. The way of, even if some of them are speaking French, the way of thinking is completely differently. I'm living in French, and we have Republican system, and I'm living in Belgium. It's a very small country between France and Germany, and it's they have a kingdom system, and the way of thinking is and it's nice to see that even if we speak the same language, the way of yes, thinking is different. So
yeah.
It's nice to grow. And I'm happy to discover Zen teaching as well. Thanks a lot.
And I want to say too that even living with a Zen practitioner, we get lots of times to see other perspectives. That you might imagine that if you were only living with someone who practiced Zen, then they would agree with you all the time. But there is this fundamental difference and reflection we get. And that image of the blood boiling just so feels like that's so much a part where the world disturbs us, right? And that's the job of the world, to disturb us. A Jewish poet talks about, he says, God disturbs us toward our destiny. God disturbs us toward our destiny. So our family's job, our partners, our parents, our siblings, is to disturb us. And our job as practitioners is to be disturbed, and not put a head on it, or to, that the disturbance is the stick. You know, you try to say something quite innocuous and gentle, like, well, this might be it, right? Are you kidding me? What's this shit you're learning here? But this is Linji's stick.
Linji's spirit, right?
Linji's spirit,
confronts us all the time.
Yeah.
And what do we do in response, right? Yeah. Right.
Yeah, he doesn't actually say, what do you think? What's your experience? No!
Yeah.
Which his teacher did to him.
Yeah. And I was thinking, just listening to it this time, when the part about the arhats being the latrine pit, I thought, actually, he might actually be telling us that the latrine pit is an arhat.
Right.
He's not just denigrating the arhats. He's saying, look at this latrine pit. You know? This is a wisdom body.
You know? That's beautiful. So tethering posts for mules.
Yes. Bow to the toilet next time, you know.
Right, because that is his teaching too. Mm. If everything is it, then
yeah,
no exceptions here.
Yeah,
it's wonderful.
Having read the reading so many times, what really jumped out at me is the cowering rat and listening, and then I thought, well, where else does excrement on a stick belong except in the latrine? And wow, there's looking outside me, no matter how shiny or beautiful it appears and is, how much of a cowering rat I have been. And excrement on a stick. I mean, it feels joy in seeing this in chasing after. How could this be it?
Yeah. Right.
And it just, on another level, just broke my heart. I've been reading reading and the part about those three is why we have to be in so much suffering. And I just felt that reading in another way. So thank you.
Thank you. And you're referring to the song of the jeweled mirror samadhi that we read today earlier in the service, which is so powerful. One of the reasons I wanted to read that is that it's written by somebody in a different lineage from Linji, Dongshan, who is one of the ancestors of the Soto school, the Zaodong school. Dong is Zaodong, To, whatever. And he says the same stuff, and he talks about all the different views, and you know, the ancients grieved for them and offered them the Dharma, right? This is another thing that I didn't comment on in this particular text, but the fortuitous, what does he say? The fortunate, the favorable, you just need to use these favorable circumstances, you know, and you've been offered the Dharma in this lifetime. Wow, that's so rare. And not only have you been offered it, you said yes to it, which is even more rare, as we know from our families.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's just to feel that the cowering rat is a vehicle and recipient of the Dharma. There are no exceptions to this. You don't have to be somebody special. You don't have to be some idea of something, but that feeling. Still, you're the one. So, thank you all.